in a tunnel.
Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's February 23rd, Monday. We're going to finish up axial skeleton. All right, who's talking up there? I see you. Shush. All right, so you got a test. This is going to be on the test. That almost quieted everybody down. Okay, you do have a test 1 week from today on all the bones, including joints. So we're going to finish up axial skeleton today and move on to joints. And I don't know if we'll finish that up today, but we'll finish it up next time. And then you got a test next time. So don't forget, here's an SI session. And I know this week you're starting your practicums, and maybe even next Monday there's a practicum. I'll see if we can't find somebody to hold an open lab this Friday as well for people that want to take the practicum or have to take the practicum on Monday. Okay, I don't know about that yet. All right, so does anybody have any questions over axial skeleton? Not so much, pretty straightforward. What's one really nice thing, I'll get to you in just a second. What's one really nice thing about spending a lot of time with bones and getting to know bones and parts of bones and processes on bones? Why is that important in anatomy?
Because most of the muscles and organs are related to
them. Yeah, because everything is related to the skeletal system. And when you know the names of bones and the processes on bones, you automatically learn a lot of neuroanatomy, vascular anatomy, and muscle anatomy, because these things are named after the bones, or the parts of bones are named after muscles that attach at those locations to bones. So it's really, really helpful. Yeah. The vertebral plate? Yeah, I can't quite hear you. The vertical plate. Vertical plate. Okay, I don't think I've ever heard of that. The vertical plate of? Oh, the palatine bone. Okay. The vertical plate makes up the lateral parts of the nasal cavity. The horizontal plate makes up the floor of the nasal cavity, or the roof of the mouth. And it's the posterior part of the hard palate. Hard palate is the part of the roof of the mouth that's made out of bone. And there are two bones that make up the hard palate: the palatine process of the maxilla, and the horizontal plate of the palatine bones. Okay, and the vertical plates make up the lateral walls of the nasal cavity. So a palatine bone looks like an L. Okay. Sign-in sheet is going around. So make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. So any other questions? I just had a really hard time hearing you. No other questions? Okay. All right, so we got done with the upper appendage. We were talking about bones of the hand. Actually, yeah, that whole distal part of the upper appendage right there. So what are the three main groups of bones that make up a hand? I'm speaking very loosely in terms of anatomic language. What kind of bones make up the hand? Carpals, metacarpals, and phalanges. Okay, so which make up the digits?
Phalanges.
The phalanges. Which make up your wrist?
Metacarpals.
Carpals. Which make up your hand?
Metacarpals.
That's the metacarpals, right? And metacarpals and phalanges are named. They're given a number 1 through 5. Which one is number 1? Which digit is number 1? Your thumb, right? Which digit only has 2 phalanges? The thumb. And what are they?
The proximal and distal.
And all your other digits also have a middle phalanx as well. All right, so that's how we talk about those things. What's the name of a carpal that you have to know?
The scaphoid.
And why is that interesting to know about?
Yeah,
it's the one that is the most clinical importance because it fractures all the time. Okay, that's the one that's most easily broken. All right, so we're done with the upper appendage, and I forget exactly where we left off. but I don't think we went to the lower appendage yet, including the pelvic girdle. All right, so remember there are some bony structures that help attach your appendages to your axial skeleton, and they're called girdles. What's a girdle? What is a girdle? Holds everything in. Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. A girdle is something that surrounds something. That's what it means, to girdle. Girdle could be a verb or girdle could be a noun. It means that something is surrounding something. And what about the pectoral girdle? What are the bones that make up the pectoral girdle? The scapula and clavicle. Okay, so they're kind of like this. The clavicle's in the anterior part of your body. The scapula's in the posterior part. And it kind of surrounds the superior part of your thoracic cavity. All right, now what about the lower girdle? What bones make up, what do we call the lower girdle for your lower appendages? The pelvic girdle. And what bones make up the pelvic girdle? Yeah, the two adcoxae, and the adcoxae, you should always remember, are made up of three primordial bones that fuse together, and we call those the ilium, ischium, and pubis. All right, so what we have here is a picture of the pelvis, all right, and so we got more than just the adcoxae right here, because here is one adcoxae, here's the pubic bone, here's the ischium, and here's the ilium. That makes up an adcoxae. Here's the one on the left, and also included in this diagram is the sacrum. The sacrum is not part of the pelvic girdle. It really should be included in what part of your skeleton? It's part of your axial skeleton, part of your axial skeleton, because it's part of your vertebrae, yeah.
Can you separate the costus from the vertebrae itself? Or they
are? Oh, yeah, there's a joint right there. There is an iliosacral joint right here.
So is this to separate, or they are fused together?
There's a joint. It's an immovable joint, though.
Oh.
Okay, it shouldn't move. It shouldn't move. But it doesn't move unless there's severe trauma. Okay, so it doesn't really move, I don't even think, with childbirth. Okay. Okay, so what do we see right here? All right, so here is what we call the pubic arch. This is the easiest way that we can differentiate between the male and female pelvis. It's very easy, probably from across the room. The pubic arch right here, if it's less than 90 degrees, signifies that it's a male pelvis. If it's greater than 90 degrees, then that means it's a female pelvis. That's the easiest way to tell, okay, when you look. Okay, so I would guess this is an exam figure. It's a very hard bone to appreciate if you just look at pictures. So you really have to look at an adcoxae in lab. And the easiest way to do that is to actually pick it up, turn it around, and position it on your body how it would fit on your body so that you can see the orientation of this thing because it has a lot of processes and holes in it. All right, so here's a lateral view of the right hip bone, all right, the right one. And, of course, you can always tell what the lateral aspect of an adcoxae is by what landmark? By the acetabulum, just like you can always tell the lateral margin of the scapula because of the glenoid fossa or glenoid cavity. So here is the acetabulum, and within the acetabulum you can see the fusion of the three bones, the pubis, ischium, and ilium, right here. All right, so this is a big depression that holds the head of the femur. So this is the second ball and socket joint that we have in our bodies. Okay, so if this is lateral, all right, the pubic bone is anterior and the ischium is posterior. So this is the posterior side of the adcoxae, this is the anterior. So look at all these processes on the posterior side. All right, we have a number of spines. Here's the posterior superior iliac spine, and then below that is the posterior inferior iliac spine because that's part of the ilium. There's also something on the posterior part of the adcoxae, which is easy to mix up from the iliac spines. All right, but notice it's on a different bone, primordial bone altogether. It's not on the ilium, it's on the ischium, and this is the ischial spine, right? So don't confuse the ischial spine with the posterior inferior iliac spine. All right, the ischial spine is between the greater sciatic notch and the lesser sciatic notch, right here. So these sciatic notches are posterior. Here is the ischial tuberosity. What's the function of that ischial tuberosity? Muscle attachment. What's the function of this ischial spine? Muscle attachment. What's the function of this posterior inferior iliac spine? Muscle attachment. These are all important muscle attachment sites. Okay. All right, the pubic bone. We have the inferior ramus of the pubic bone and the superior ramus of the pubic bone, and then we have a couple rough raised areas right here, the tubercle and the crest for muscle attachment as well. So now we're on the anterior side, and you can see that here's the anterior superior iliac crest and the anterior inferior iliac crest corresponding to what? The posterior side. But you got to know which side is anterior and posterior in order to see that. And what's the best way to appreciate that? Actually, place it on your body so you can see how it fits. All right. And of course, look in lab. So this is the ala right here of the ilium. And then here is the iliac crest. Guess what the function of this iliac crest is right here? Muscle attachment. All right. So now let's look at the medial view, looking at the inside of an ascoxae. So here is the body of the ilium right here. This is the iliac fossa, which is on the medial side. The lateral side is what we call the ala, this fan right here. But on the inside, this bowl right here. What's the function of the iliac fossa? It's to hold something, and you don't know what it's holding in there yet. But organs, right, inside your body. Okay, urinary bladder, part of the large intestine. Okay. All right, so would you guess that this right here is the anterior side or the posterior side? The anterior, because the pubis is always going to be anterior. That's kind of another way of looking at this. All right, so here is the anterior superior and then anterior inferior iliac spine. And clearly you can see now the superior ramus of the pubis. And then here is the ischium. And there's that ischial spine once again. All right, and then over here, okay, you see the smooth, it's relatively smooth, all right, articulating surface. So we call this the auricular surface of the ascoxae. And guess what articulates with the ascoxae right here? Guess what bone that is? That's the sacrum. Right, so the sacrum goes between the two auricular surfaces of the ascoxae. So this should be a little bit smooth compared to this area here, which should be pretty rough. Yeah, question.
Is that the best way we were talking about?
Yeah, the sacrum is, well, it's at the five vertebrae that are all fused together. Yeah. Okay. So you guys got a question up there? You guys got a question? No. Okay. Just make sure you don't disturb anybody. All right. So if you need to talk about something coming up, just go out in the hallway. Okay. Okay. All right. So here is the bone of the. Tell me what part of the body is this? Do you find this bone? It's between your hip and your knee. What's between your hip and your knee? That's your thigh. All right. So think of thigh. The bone of the thigh is the femur, all right? And where I have the cursor right here, is that a lateral or medial aspect of the femur? Lateral, right? Because the medial aspect is going to have the head of the femur, right? So here you can see the head of the femur, and if you palpate that, you'll see that it's nice and smooth, all right? Because it's an articular surface. What bone does this articulate with, and what part of the bone? It articulates with the acetabulum of the ilium, which is part of the ascoxae bone, right? All right, so here's the head, and there's a little pit in the head of the femur, which we call the fovea capitis, and so there's a ligament that holds the head of the femur into the acetabulum. The ligament goes And don't forget, a ligament is a bone-to-bone connection. It's a ligament that goes from the head of the femur into the acetabulum, and it stabilizes the hip joint. And also, in that ligament is a blood vessel that brings nourishment to the head of the femur right here, because remember, what kind of tissue is bone? Is that, I tell you what, guys, you want to step out of the class? I really don't want you bugging people that are trying to concentrate on lecture. Okay, so if you need to talk, just step outside, okay? Okay. Okay, so that blood vessel nourishes the head of the femur right here. And what kind of pressures and tension and forces do you think that the hip joint has to undergo in everyday life? Probably a lot, because it's holding up most of our body weight, right? And you're using it to walk and to sit down and to bend over and pick things up. So it undergoes a lot of stress. And so that ligament can be damaged. All right. And when that ligament is damaged, guess what happens to the blood vessel? It gets damaged as well, because it's right in that ligament. And then guess what happens to the head of the femur right here? Okay. It atrophies. It dissolves away. Okay. And so we call that bone necrosis. So you can imagine what that would be like. What would happen to somebody's mobility of their hip if this whole part of the femur dissolved away? Well, they really wouldn't have a hip joint anymore. It'd be extremely painful. But there's a nice easy solution to that. I guess it's easy for us to think about it. That would be a hip replacement, right? Hip replacement at that point in time. Okay. That certainly can happen with the knee, not as susceptible as the hip. Okay. She had a knee replaced. That is, yeah, that could be due to overuse injury as well, inappropriate use of the knee joint. One thing about the hip is that typically it is a lot stronger. The ball and socket joint, the ball inserts itself very deep into the acetabulum, so it's a fairly stable joint compared to the shoulder joint, where the glenoid fossa is very shallow. I'll mention something about that probably in the next chapter. But there was a professional athlete who played, and this is pretty amazing just by itself, he played professional football and professional baseball at the same time. He was just such an astounding athlete. Anybody know who that was? Okay, that was Bo Jackson, not too long ago, maybe before some of your time. But playing football, he injured his hip joint and injured that ligamentum teres that fits into the fovea capitis right here. And because of that injury, right, the femur started to degenerate. And so he had to have a hip replacement. So you could imagine what would happen to most of us if we needed a hip replacement. All right, we'd be off of work for a year and convalescing and all that kind of stuff. But Mr. Jackson was such an incredible athlete, he went back and even played professional baseball even with an artificial hip. So I'm just amazed at that. He was probably smart enough and wise enough not ever to go back and play football because of the trauma to his hip. But he still nonetheless went back and played baseball. So that's, I suppose, why I say it can be easily treated. Okay, because depending on your motivation and what kind of damage you have, and probably depends a little bit of what kind of experts you have working on you, right, it can be dealt with very effectively. All right, so then here is the neck of the femur. We don't have a surgical neck on the femur like we do the humerus, but we do have a couple very prominent muscle attachment points, but we call these trochanters on the femur. And guess what the function of these trochanters are here and here? Okay, therefore, muscle attachment, right? All right, so you can see the intertrochanteric line on the anterior femur and this intertrochanteric crest on the posterior part of the femur. That's another good way to see what the posterior and anterior aspect of the femur is.
Question.
Yeah.
So the neck then is the place where it is mostly
growing. Yeah, right here. Right here. And there's a fossa in there. That fossa might be on your list to study for the practicum. I'm not sure. There's a depression, right, on the posterior side of the femur between the greater trochanter and lesser trochanter right here. All right, and then we got the diaphysis. The diaphysis has muscle attachments to it. And we can see the linea aspera, right? That's a nice long area for muscle attachment. And we have the gluteal tuberosity, which forms the superior part of the linea aspera after it bifurcates. Okay, let's go down to the posterior part of the femur, and we can see the nice condylar surfaces, the nice smooth condyles right here. What's the function of these condyles for? Articulations. These are articulating surfaces with the bone below it, which is the tibia, but also another bone, which is what we call the kneecap or the patella. All right, so that's a good bone. I can't imagine anybody missing this on a practicum, but you know what students do for some reason, so I don't know if I just forget to mention it in lecture, but you can mix this bone up with another bone that's part of your axial skeleton. What's another bone that sort of looks like this that's part of your axial skeleton? The sternum. Somebody said sternum, but what part of the sternum? The manubrium sort of has a little bit of a triangular shape to it. It's almost about the same size, right? The superior bone of the sternum. All right, but you shouldn't really ever get this one confused with the manubrium, because the manubrium really isn't as triangular as the patella. Plus, the manubrium doesn't have these smooth articulating surfaces, okay, on the posterior part of the patella. Yeah. Usually no, it's connected, but there's a joint there at the sternal angle, and we have a manubrium in lab that you could look at that's all by itself if you wanted to see it, okay? Okay, so this pointy part of the patella right here is what we call the apex, right? That's just the pointy triangular part of any kind of triangle. Okay, now what is interesting about the patella right here? What kind of bone is it? Is it a long bone? Is it irregular, or what kind of bone is it? We actually classified bones like this way back when, a couple weeks ago, it's a sesamoid bone, all right? So that means that it is completely within a tendon, and the tendon goes from some very strong muscles of your anterior thigh, your quadriceps, and then that tendon then proceeds inferiorly off the apex here and inserts into the tibia, and we'll see where it inserts into the tibia in just a little bit. All right, so the articular surface of the patella articulates with the patellar surface of the femur right here. That's where it fits in. Okay, so here you can see the medial condyles, all right, the lateral condyles of the femur. Easy to tell because you can always look at the head of the femur to see which is medial and lateral. Oh, you know, it just all depends on the amount of degeneration, where it is. And, you know, I'm not even sure exactly what bones. It might only include the femur, but sometimes it might only include the tibia. Sometimes it might include both. So it all depends on what's indicated. Okay, I'm not really sure. Okay, so here is the bones of the... What is this right here? This is a leg. Between your knee and your ankle is a leg. Lateral is fibula, and the medial is the tibia. All right, so here is the tibial tuberosity. All right, this is what accepts the patellar ligament from the patella. And so what's the function of this tibial tuberosity right here? It's really a muscle attachment by way of the ligament from the patella. Right, but muscles from your anterior thigh insert right here. All right, so we have the condylar surfaces on the superior part of the tibia. There's going to be a little ridge right in the middle. We call that the intercondylar eminence. Right, that fits between the lateral and medial condyles of the femur. There are some ligaments that attach right here, which help stabilize the knee. We'll look at those in the next chapter. Okay, then these bony prominences down here are what we call the malleoli. And here's the medial malleolus because, of course, the tibia is medial, and the fibula is lateral. So here's a lateral malleolus. And I think that's really all I'm going to mention about the tibia and the fibula. Okay. What are the parts you have to memorize? Well, if this is an exam figure, anything that's labeled right here. Okay, including the interosseous membrane. Now, where else did you see an interosseous membrane? Yeah, between the radius and the ulna in your forearm, right? Okay. Now, in lab, you know what? You might have to be able to recognize the head of the fibula from the lateral malleolus right here. So how could you, I don't think anyone's going to ask you the difference between the right and left fibula, but maybe between the proximal and distal aspect of the fibula. How is it that you can see, recognize the difference between the proximal and distal epiphysis of a fibula? Okay. It's not intuitive to me, okay, because when I look at my ankle or anybody's ankle, right, and I'm going to be looking at the lateral malleolus for the fibula, there's this big bony thing that's sticking out, right? There's this on your ankle. But if when you look at the fibula, you're going to see one end that's pretty thin, kind of looks like a blade, and another end that's big and bulgy, right? More looks more like a club. And intuitively, I would think that the thing that looks more like a club is the distal part of the fibula, right? But that's not really the case. The distal part is the lateral malleolus right here is the thinner part. The more club-like part is the proximal epiphysis of the fibula. Okay, so I kind of use an analogy of the clavicle. Remember, there's a part of the clavicle that's club-like, kind of looks like the opening of a trumpet or something, and there's one part that looks more like a blade. All right, so use that same analogy. In terms of the clavicle, which one looks more like an opening of a trumpet? Is that the manubrial end, or is that the sternal end, or the acromial end? That's the sternal end, is big and bony, and the blade-like part of the clavicle is the acromial end. Okay, so that's the more distal part of the clavicle, is the blade-like. So in terms of the fibula, right, the club-like end is the superior part, or the proximal epiphysis, and the blade-like is the distal epiphysis. Kind of the same way that you would want to think of the clavicle. It kind of matches up. Yeah. Okay. Let me get a picture. Let me call that picture up. The lateral epicondyle of the femur. Okay. Fibula. And okay, let's go back. You might articulate a little bit with both. Okay. Well, now the epicondyle doesn't articulate in the knee. It has ligaments and joint capsule, all right, but the bones that really touch each other that form the joint are just the femur and the tibia. Okay, so I don't think I have a picture of them both together. So the lateral condyle of the femur, right, articulates with the lateral articular surface, right? I'm sorry, right here, the articular surface of the lateral condyle of the tibia, which is here and here. The medial condyle of the femur articulates with the medial condyle of the tibia. Okay. All right, and so there are ligaments that go from the epicondyle to the head of the, and the condyle of the femur, I'm sorry, the condyle of the fibula actually articulates with the, oh, is that what you're saying? The lateral epicondyle of the tibia. Okay. All right, so that takes us to the last bones of the axial skeleton, and that's your foot. Make sure that you can tell the difference between a hand and a foot quickly. In lab, somebody might ask you, and if you don't pay attention, it's probably easy to mix up. The names of the bones are sort of similar in the hand and the foot. We have ankle bones. What's the corresponding region in the hand for ankle? That would be your? Okay. But I mean in terms of like everyday language, your wrist, dang. Your ankle is your? The wrist, okay. So what are the bones in your wrist called again? They're carpals. The bones that make up your ankle, right, are what we call tarsals. All right, so here are tarsals, and you got to know two of them. The most superior one is the talus, and the one that's inferior, and the talus right here articulates with the tibia and fibula, and then inferior to the talus is the calcaneus, and that's your heel bone. That's what you strike on the ground all the time. So those are important articulating bones of the ankle, but nonetheless, all the rest of them are what we call tarsals. All right, and then the bones... The bones of the hand are called?
Phalanx.
Okay, bones of the hand are called? Metacarpal. So bones of the foot are called metatarsals. And again, they're just named 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right, maybe in a few cases, 6. All right, if you have polydactyly. All right, so those are the foot. And then your digits are your? Phalanges, just like in your fingers, and they're named the same. Your big toe only has two, proximal and distal. All of your other digits have three. Okay, so here's the proximal, here's the middle, and then here is the distal number two. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, for instance, let's name... Oh, well, that one's too easy. Okay. Let's name, I don't know if I can see this one well enough. Okay, so let's name this one right here, where I have my cursor. What's that? That's middle. Middle what? Middle. I lost the cursor. Come on, give me a chance. What's it doing way up there? Ah, now I don't even remember where I had it, probably here. Okay, that's middle number three. And what do we call it? Phalanx. This is singular, phalanx. Middle number three, phalanx.
On our last practicum, the right arm, the middle.
Number three, phalanx. Yeah. And of course, don't say middle number three, phalanx, distal, because I wouldn't know what to say about that. Okay? Okay, so. Of the, and I suppose you could say of the, you know, right foot or something. All right, if you want to know what all of these bones make, they make up a digit. Okay, so where I have the cursor, that's just the number two digit. All right, so again, here's the calcaneus. Here's the talus. All right, here are the rest of the tarsals, metatarsals, and then the phalanges. And there are a number of arches in the foot. Okay, you have a longitudinal. Okay, medial longitudinal arch right here. You have a transverse arch. Right, and you even have a lateral arch right here. And the reason for the arches is just to distribute weight when you place your whole body weight on your foot so that it doesn't destroy any of the joints of the tarsals over here. Okay, and people have problems with their feet, right? If they don't have these arches, what do we call that condition when a person doesn't have? We just call that a flat foot, and they might even actually need to wear some kind of prosthetic device to even introduce an arch into their foot for walking and for posture. Okay. So I think that's it for the axial skeleton. Here's a good example. Here's the here's a clavicle again. So this end right here, is this the flatter end or the more club-like end? That's the flatter end, right? And the sternal end is going to be more club-like. You can't really see it from this picture because you have to look at it on end of the bone. Okay. Okay, any questions on the appendicular skeleton. Is that on your practicum too, or just axial skeleton? That's on your practicum too? Yeah? Okay. Alright, so so we're going to move to articulations. And what's a common name for articulation? That's just a joint. And what the heck is a joint? What's a joint? Where two bones come together, right? Where two bones come together. And some joints are movable, some are immovable, and some are sort of in between, okay? All right, so let's classify joints. We can classify joints by their structure, or we can classify joints by their function. All right, so it's good to get an appreciation of a joint by either one of these classifications. So don't forget, articulations are sites where two or more bones come together, and joints give the human skeleton mobility and also the ability to hold itself together. All right, so let's talk about joints by their structural classification. And when we talk about a structural classification, we're talking about the material, the kind of material that actually makes up the joint, or the material that binds the bones together. They can be fibrous joints. Guess what's in a fibrous joint? Okay, fibers. And what kind of fibers would you choose? How about elastic fibers? How about reticular fibers? If you have reticular fibers making up a fibrous joint, it's going to come apart because it's a very weak fiber. If it's elastic, it's going to come apart as well, and it may go back to where it was at the beginning. All right, that might seem like an okay thing. All right, but fibrous joints have collagen, dense, regular connective tissue in them. All right, another kind by structure is a cartilaginous joint. So guess what it has in there? It's got cartilage in there, cartilaginous. And then the third classification, this is the most complicated, is a synovial joint. And we're going to spend a little bit of time looking at a synovial joint. We're not going to look at any different compositions of a fibrous and cartilaginous joint, but there's going to be some important components that make up a synovial joint. All right, so you're going to have to learn maybe five or six things about a synovial joint. All right, so you got fibrous, cartilaginous, and synovial by structure, but then also by function. All right, so what's the function of a joint usually? It's for movement or motion, right? And so we can classify joints by the amount of motion that they allow. A synarthrosis are immovable joints. Some good examples of these will be, for instance, sutures. Where do you find a suture? In your head, yeah, in your skull, between bones of the skull. Ooh, let's see. I maybe have some pictures. We'll go look at for some pictures in just a little bit. All right, so synarthrosis is immovable. Amphiarthrosis is slightly movable. All right, for instance, the intervertebral joints between what parts of the vertebrae articulate with each other? What parts of the vertebrae? The bodies of the vertebrae articulate with each other, okay, and then also the superior and inferior articulating processes articulate with each other. So those are amphiarthroses, and then a diarthrosis, these are freely movable joints. Give me a name of a freely movable joint. Like your shoulder joint. Okay, your interphalangeal joints and your knee, those are freely movable, for instance, and your temporomandibular joint, okay, that's a freely movable joint, which we call a diarthrosis. All right, so how can you remember synarthrosis, amphiarthrosis, and diarthrosis as being immovable, slightly movable, and freely movable? Because make a little acronym, we see SAD right here. And just think of SAD, right? S for synarthrosis, A for amphiarthrosis, and D for diarthrosis, from the degree of movability of those joints. Okay, let me see if I can find Some slides of these things. Okay, so here is an example of a suture. What kind of joint is this? Okay. Synarthrosis by function. Okay, but by structure, what kind of joint is it? I wish I could really zoom in. This is a fibrous joint. It's a fibrous joint. Okay. I haven't talked about these yet, so let me go back. All right, so let's talk about fibrous joints in particular. All right, so fibrous joints, where bones are connected by dense regular connective tissue, they lack a joint cavity. The only thing that's between the bones is collagen. Some examples of these would be sutures, so we can see that's what I just showed you. That's an immovable joint. All right, a syndesmosis, connected exclusively by ligaments. The amount of movement varies. All right, so sometimes a syndesmosis might be a synarthrosis, or it might be a amphiarthrosis. Some examples of these would be, for instance, the distal tibiofibular joint. That's a synarthrosis. That's also immovable. The radial ulnar interosseous membrane. Okay, so what can you tell me about that interosseous membrane? When you move your arm like this.
Movable.
Yeah, it's slightly movable. Okay? So, that's what we call a diarthrosis. Okay? Oh no, freely movable. That's a diarthrosis. Okay, freely movable. And then a gomphosis is a peg and socket joint. Right? Where do you find a peg and socket joint? Or gomphosis, that's between the root of a tooth and the, what do you call that hole in the mandible? Yeah, an alveolus, right? And there is a ligament that holds that, it's called the periodontal ligament. And of course, how movable are your teeth in your jaw? Not so much, right? That would be what, a synarthrosis. Or it's immovable, your teeth shouldn't be moving around in there. Yeah. Right here? Function. Okay, so we're talking about fibrous joints. That's a type of structural classification. But even though we understand the structure of that joint, it might have different functions associated with it as well. Okay? So one that is freely movable, all right, would be the radial ulnar interosseous membrane joint. There's one that would be a synarthrosis, that would be a suture, and a gomphosis. So just by knowing a joint by its structural classification, you should maybe also think of it in terms of its functional classification as well. Okay, so that F stands for function. Say it again. Osseous. I have it right here someplace. Oh, osseous. What's the root of that?
Yeah.
Osseous. I don't know. I'm going to have to look that up. Okay, osseous. It means it has something to do with a bone, and maybe it means like a process, some kind of process that a bone goes through. It's some kind of functional process that a bone goes through. Yeah. So it's bone function. It probably means articulating function of a bone is probably what that means. But maybe I'll see what kind of Greek derivation that comes from. Osseous. Anytime you see that O in there, osteo, you know, I kind of think of bone. All right, so fibrous joints, that's a structural classification. Let's go to the next structural classification, that is cartilaginous. Wait, before we do that, let's check this out. Okay, so here's a syndesmosis. That's just a ligament, right, between the tibia and fibula. That's immovable. And this gomphosis is the periodontal ligaments right here. That is also what a synarthrosis. That's an immovable joint. All right, so now we're looking at some cartilaginous joints. Cartilaginous joints. What's a good way to think of these? All right, synchondrosis. Right, chondro signifies what? Cartilage, united by hyaline cartilage. And it's immovable. All right, so it says synarthrosis. Some examples would be the epiphyseal plate or epiphyseal disc. Where did we see that? All right, so in a prepubertal individual, this is the secondary ossification center. All right, and this is how the bone grows in length. But this joint right here should not be moving. And of course, if it ever does move, that damages the epiphyseal plate and probably will disrupt or impede the growth of that bone. All right? Okay. Let's see. A good example of another cartilaginous joint is a symphysis, which is made out of fibrocartilage. It's slightly movable. All right, the intervertebral discs and the pubic symphysis are examples. So here's a symphysis. This is a intervertebral disc. And do I have it on the next slide? No, I don't. But I don't want to bump out of this, but remember the ascoxae. To form a pelvis, the two pubic bones come together, right? And where they come together, that doesn't form an ossified bone, right? That forms, right, a symphysis, sort of like the intervertebral disc right here. And that's fortunate because that joint can actually be dissolved away right before childbirth so that the ascoxae can actually separate and enlarge the birth canal. All right, and then after parturition, what happens? The two pelvic bones or the two ascoxae more or less come back together again, okay, and it fuses again.
It fuses because the symphysis grows back.
Yeah, the symphysis more or less can grow back, yeah. Or if you go through... I don't know of anybody that's actually measured the approximation of the two pubic bones, right? If it gets farther and farther apart, maybe somebody kind of has an understanding of that if you've had multiple children. Okay, you know, I'm not really sure what happens. Or if it goes back to the same degree. It never really goes back the way that it was originally.
Does it get the same
break? Yeah, sure does. Okay. And so even a guy can damage their pubic symphysis. For instance, if you go through the handlebars of your motorcycle, okay, that's going to fracture. Fortunately, that can go back together again, but probably not quite the way it was. All right, but it's probably as strong as before.
The discs.
Okay, what about those discs?
The intervertebral discs.
Yes, ma'am.
If those get damaged, they don't grow back?
Those heal very, very poorly. Because remember, there's some internal structure. There's the annulus fibrosus, which is a ring on the outside. And then there's the nucleus pulposus, which is a gelatinous material on the inside. It's a gelatinous pillow. And once that pillow leaks out, that gelatinous mass leaks out, it really doesn't repair itself. And even the annulus fibrosus doesn't repair itself. That's interesting. Somebody should really do a lot of research on the pubic symphysis to find out why it grows back and how to get it to grow back, because guess what we might be able to apply that to? Yeah, how to heal intervertebral discs. Yeah, that would be fascinating. Somebody's probably thought of that, but I've never seen any research. That would be considered what?
Crushed disc.
A crushed?
Crushed.
Yeah. Yeah. That can also be due to osteoporosis, because as the body of the vertebrae degenerate, they might start to angulate a little bit, all right, and get weaker and crush. And when the surfaces of the two bodies of the vertebrae aren't flat anymore, then they'll have a tendency to push down on that disc in certain locations as well. Okay. So I couldn't tell you if that's that intervertebral disc right here is diseased just because of itself, or what the contribution is from the vertebral body right there. Sometimes it goes hand in hand. Okay, another kind of joint. Synovial joints. And you have an exam figure of a synovial joint that you have to know about. All of these, by function, are what kind of joints? In everyday language, all synovial joints are freely movable. And what's the word we use for freely movable? Yeah, SAD, the D in SAD, that is what, a diarthrosis? Okay, so give me some examples of synovial joints. Yeah, your knee, all your finger joints, your shoulder, your hip, your temporomandibular joint. These are the structural features that you'll have to be able to identify on a synovial joint. You've got articular cartilage. Where do you think the articular cartilage is going to be? On the, covering the epiphyses of the bones that are approximating each other. You have a joint cavity filled with synovial fluid, and that synovial fluid comes from the synovial membrane that lines the cavity. Then on the outside of that synovial membrane, you have a fibrous capsule. And if we take the synovial membrane with the fibrous capsule, we get the articular capsule. And on the inside of that articular capsule, guess what you got? The joint cavity filled with synovial fluid. Okay, then on the outside of the joint capsule, you have some reinforcing ligaments, nerves, blood vessels, bursa, maybe a tendon sheath. And then also, some, but not all, actually very few synovial joints have an articular disc. And sometimes we call that articular disc a meniscus. All right, so let's look at a synovial joint. All right, so here's a pretty typical synovial joint. This could be an example maybe between an interphalangeal joint of your finger, or this could be a model of your shoulder or hip or any of those, because they're all synovial joints. All right, so covering the epiphyses of the bones is the articular cartilage right here and right here. It does not contain blood vessels, so once it is damaged, guess how quickly it repairs itself? Well, it just doesn't, right? Very, very poor regenerative capabilities. Okay, where it gets its nourishment from is from the synovial fluid right here within the joint cavity. Right, and what secretes the synovial fluid? The synovial membrane that we see right here. That's the synovial membrane. So the synovial membrane does have a vascular supply. Yeah?
I mean, if there is like the synovial fluid in those two, what about the meniscus or the cartilage? Is it supposed to be in the middle of them?
Okay, well, if this is a knee, there would be a meniscus there. Okay, and there's no blood supply to a meniscus either, so menisci don't repair themselves. Once they're damaged, they're damaged. Yeah, I'll show you some knee. A knee you do have to know a lot about in particular. So we'll spend some time looking at the knee. But nonetheless, the knee has everything that you see here plus the menisci, the additional structure. All right, so where was I? Hyaline cartilage. The hyaline cartilage is maintained by the synovial fluid of the joint cavity, which is secreted by the synovial membrane right here. And then, now don't forget that synovial membrane is not very strong, so it's reinforced by the fibrous capsule, right, that has collagen associated with it, and that still is not enough to stabilize a joint. On the outside of the joint capsule or articular capsule right here, you have ligaments and tendons that go across the knee to stabilize the knee. Right, so here is a ligament because that we see just what a bone-to-bone connection. And then superficial to that will be what? Muscles and tendons that even stabilize the knee joint even more. And that you don't see on this particular diagram. All right, so the joint capsule is made out of what? The synovial membrane, right? And the fibrous capsule, synovial membrane, makes the synovial fluid. And that synovial fluid nourishes the hyaline cartilage because there's living cells in there, but it also provides for lubrication. Right? So that's that serous fluid or the synovial fluid actually is coming from the synovial membrane right here. And the joint has to move in order for that synovial fluid to remain a liquid. Otherwise, it will have a tendency to not really solidify, but it will gel up. Okay? So if you want to keep your joints healthy, what do you have to do to your joints?
Move.
You have to move. That's right. So even with somebody that has arthritis and their joints hurt, what do we have to tell them? Tell me.
Move.
Move. You have to move. That's right. You have to keep those joints moving. All right? Okay. Okay. All right, so that's a pretty typical synovial joint right there. Here is an example of a synovial joint because we can see what the hyaline cartilage, articular cartilage. We can see the joint cavity right here. What's in that joint cavity? Synovial fluid that comes from the synovial membrane, and then surrounding the synovial, on the outside of the synovial membrane is the fibrous capsule, and that makes the joint capsule right here. But here we see that between these two bones, there's an extra layer of protection, and this is what we call the articular discs. And you should know two joints in here that have articular discs. Okay, one is pretty obvious, we're pretty much aware of, and that is your knee. It has two menisci. There's a medial and a lateral meniscus. But there's another joint. Does anybody know of an example of another joint that has the... And you would talk to your dentist about this one if it's misbehaving. That is your temporomandibular joint. Your TMJ has an articular disc. Because what can you do with your TMJ? Okay, you can elevate your jaw, you can lower your jaw, you can rotate it laterally or to both sides, right? You can protract it, meaning you can stick your jaw out from your face, you can retract it. So that's a pretty complicated joint because it has all of that motion. So that articular disc in the TMJ is important for stabilizing the jaw. Okay. You don't have to know much about a shoulder joint, all right? But I will point a few things out. And so what is the function of the joint capsule and the articular cartilage? What's the function of the joint capsule? It's to provide what? A lot of mobility. It's a freely movable joint. All right, but the whole process is to, yeah?
Friction.
To reduce friction, right? Because whenever you have things in your body that are moving, if there's friction between them, that's going to cause an inflammation, which is going to cause more inflammation, which is going to cause what? More inflammation or pain, which is going to cause more friction, more inflammation and pain. So it's kind of a nasty cycle to get into. So the function of that joint capsule is to reduce friction and to prevent inflammation within various joints. Okay, so how does a synovial joint reduce friction? Give me some components of a synovial joint that defeats friction. The synovial fluid, which lubricates the articular cartilage, right, so that the ends of bones don't grind each other away. Oh, what do we call it when ends of bones can actually touch each other and grind each other away?
Pain.
Yeah, that's pain. But that's called arthritis, right, because the joint cartilage is damaged. That's what arthritis is all about. Okay. Well, there are other places very close to joints or associated with joints that undergo a lot of motion and can develop a lot of friction, but there are some things there that defeat the inflammation, that reduce friction as well, and they're very similar to a joint capsule, and they are called bursa and tendon sheets. So, and we see both right here in the shoulder. So here is the subacromial bursa, and you can see it kind of looks like a pillow. On the inside is synovial fluid. There's a synovial membrane with a fibrous capsule around it, and it separates what the acromion of the scapula and the head of the humerus right here, right? Because there is no articular surface on the acromion, but here is a bursa, so that when you move your humerus around, this little pillow squishes and slides around and reduces inflammation, but still allows for a lot of mobility of the shoulder joint.
Can you replace a bursa?
I don't know if you can or not. I've not ever heard of that being done. Okay. When it does get inflamed, it can persist for a really long period of time, months, maybe even 6 months. It might maybe not ever really go away, because what's going to happen? Well, it's going to swell up and become irritated, and it's going to be very painful. And as this one swells up, you can see what? That it really produces more friction and more irritation in the shoulder joint. So what do we call that when you have an inflamed bursa? Pain, yes, but it's also called bursitis. All right, so any place where you have bones that are very close to each other that might rub up against each other, or maybe muscles that are going to pound up against the bone when they contract, you usually have a bursa between the bone and that muscle, or between two bones. But think of it as what? A nice synovial cavity between those two bones, or between... Absolutely. Or the orthopod will have to figure out where it exactly is going to go. I don't know where they actually like to put their cortisone. Okay? Just don't know. Okay, so there's a similar structure that is very similar to a bursa, but it surrounds a tendon. It has all the same components to it, and we call these tendon sheaths. So here you can see the synovial fluid inside that cavity with the synovial membrane and fibrous capsule, and it is wrapping around this tendon right here, which goes to the biceps brachii muscle, which is the muscle for flexing your forearm and also flexing your arm. And you can see that this tendon goes all the way over through the joint of the shoulder, over the head of the humerus, and inserts into the supraglenoid tubercle. Now we have that for you to know in lab. You don't have a really good picture in your book, but you should know the supraglenoid tubercle, because that's a attachment point, very important attachment point for the biceps brachii. Who's heard of the biceps brachii? Probably everybody, even before you took an anatomy class. So you should know, even though your book doesn't make a big deal of it, you should know about this tendon right here going through the shoulder and attaching to the scapula right here at the supraglenoid tubercle. And so there's, of course, a lot of friction that is associated with this tendon, and so it is surrounded by a tendon sheet, which does what? It prevents inflammation as well. Okay, so here is the infraglenoid tubercle. And there's another important muscle that attaches here, but it's on the posterior part of your arm. So I'm just kind of reinforcing supraglenoid tubercle and infraglenoid tubercle. Guess what the name of that muscle is on your posterior arm over here that attaches? That is your triceps brachii. Okay, we didn't get the muscles yet, but you'll see that. So I'm just trying to reinforce infraglenoid tubercle and supraglenoid tubercle. In case you might have it on your practicum, I'm not sure. All right, notice the depth of the glenoid fossa right here. It's pretty shallow. All right, so that means a couple things that I'll introduce to you, a concept of a trade-off. So what's a trade-off? What's a trade-off? How about you can buy a Suburban, okay, which means what? If you have a Suburban, it means you could have, you can't have an open bar in a Suburban, only if you're parked because it's big enough, but you could have what, a couple TV sets, right, in a Suburban. It's a huge vehicle, very comfortable. Couches, all right, all kinds of nice things. All right, so when you have a Suburban, you have all those nice accoutrements, but what's the downside to that? Gasoline. All right, so that's what we call a trade-off. When you buy one thing, you have to give something away. All right, so what's the trade-off that you see here in the shoulder? The glenoid cavity is very shallow. What's the good thing about that? You have an extreme range of motion, because it's a ball and socket joint. You have good range of motion. You have good dexterity. All right, but what's the downside? the shoulder is not very stable. It can be damaged. It can't sustain a lot of trauma as a result of that. Okay? So one thing that makes the socket joint a little bit deeper that stabilizes the shoulder joint is this little tissue right here. Oh, is it labeled? No, but I mentioned this before. This is the glenoid labrum. Okay, glenoid labrum, and that increases the stability of the shoulder joint. But you can see what this is, soft tissue. It's not bone, so it's not as strong as another kind of ball and socket joint.
Okay, so those kind of membranes are those bones are damaged. Is there any way to test it to them or?
Not very. There's some very nice procedures. Okay, I forgot the name of the procedure, but you have many muscles, and we're going to look at muscles coming up really, really soon, that go across the shoulder joint, and some of the muscles participate in and actually form part of the joint capsule, all right, and that's called rotator cuff, all right, and that can be damaged, and there are some very nice reconstructive surgeries that can rebuild the rotator cuff if it's torn. But there's a trade-off associated with that reconstructive surgery. It provides for a very strong shoulder joint, but guess what you're giving away? Mobility, range of motion. Okay? So you might actually end up with a shoulder that's twice or three times as strong, but you can't rotate it laterally quite so much anymore. Even with therapy, you can't do that. I'm sorry?
What about the bursa itself? The bursa.
Oh, the bursa. Wow. I don't know.
Because it seems like they can build something out of it, like an artificial one. Build something out of it.
Yeah, maybe in the future. Okay, I don't know of any really good artificial bursae, but I'm very interested in all of those things. Okay, if you want to do a Google and see. The thing with the human body is that what about all these things right here? They're alive. Even that bone is alive. Right, and so if you transplant something that's not alive, I don't know how long it's going to last you. Okay, yeah, but if it's made out of inanimate tissue, it won't be rejected, like steel and things like that. But I just don't know very many good materials that you can put into a joint, okay, to get it back the way it was. I think there is an artificial synovial fluid that they're trying, but again, it doesn't rejuvenate itself, right? It has to be replaced. All right, so those are all very interesting things, and when we get to the next chapter, we'll actually see how to protect a joint. The best thing is, of course, not to know how to rebuild a joint, but how to keep it from getting damaged in the first place. And that has to do with what muscles that go across a joint, which is not part of this particular chapter. All right, so you see that bursa, you see this tendon sheath right here that does what? The function of these things is to reduce inflammation, prevent friction from occurring. Okay, here we go. I've been wanting to talk about this for a long time. All right. Movements allowed by joints that are movable. What kind of joints are freely movable again? Okay, the diarthrosis. The diarthrosis are freely movable. Okay. Okay, three basic types. We got a gliding type of motion where a bone just glides over the surface of another one, like for instance maybe between some carpals. Most are angular motions. For instance, give me a name of a joint that kind of reminds you of maybe a door that's just opening and closing. It's an angular motion. Like maybe elbow. That's a good one. Okay, knee. Right? Your fingers, like this. Right? Are angular motions. Then there's another kind that we call rotation. All right? When a bone can rotate around the long axis of another bone. How about, right, when the radius rotates within the radial notch of the humerus, when we do this kind of motion. Or, for instance, when the head of the humerus, okay, rotates within the glenoid cavity, that's a rotation. So I'm doing a lateral rotation and a medial rotation. Would you like to talk about another rotation? How about this? Okay. Right lateral rotation, left lateral rotation of what joint is doing that? Okay, that's between C1 and C2, not between C1 and the occipital bone. Okay. Okay, so that would be a rotation. All right, so let's look at some of these. Okay, so the carpal bones, these are a gliding kind of motion. All right, now flexion and extension. Flexion is when you have two bones and they articulate and you decrease the angle between those two bones. So right now between my humerus and my ulna, it is what, 180 degrees. If I decrease it, what's that angle going to go to? Maybe 90 degrees, right? That's decreasing. Or maybe 20 degrees. That's what we call flexion. Whenever we decrease that angle, that is flexion. And then the opposite motion is what we call extension. That's when we increase the angle between two bones. All right, and so that probably is the most important concept that you could ever learn in an anatomy or physiology class. Because what's the relationship between flexion and extension? What's the they're opposite to each other. And what do you usually think of things that are opposite to each other? And what do we call that? What do we call that when there are mechanisms or something that operates in opposition to each other? Okay. That's what we call antagonism. Okay, when something works in opposition to each other. All right, now, what kind of connotation does that word antagonism have for you? Is it a good connotation or a bad connotation when you say something is antagonistic? Especially maybe to yourself. It is what? Well, it's bad. It's lousy. But in terms of biology, and in particular in terms of control systems on how your body is controlled, right, it's a very good thing. So I want to change your opinion completely around. Antagonism is really a beautiful thing. It's really good. All right, so what are the two antagonistic motions of the elbow? They are flexion and extension. Flexion is controlled by the biceps muscle. Extension is controlled by the triceps muscle. But what do you have as a result of that antagonism between those two muscle groups? You have precise control and balance of your fingertip. Right? And without that antagonism, all right, that would be really terrible. For instance, if you only had a biceps muscle but not a triceps, what would happen? Right, if you contracted your biceps, what would happen? Well, you'd poke yourself in the eye or give yourself a bloody nose or something like that, okay? Or later on this week, maybe Friday night, when you get pulled over by that person with the fancy blue uniform and the badge, the cap and the sidearm, and they say, put your finger on your nose, what do you want to do? You want to tell the officer, right? Oh, well, I have complete nice balance and precise control because my antagonistic muscles are working just fine. Even with my eyes closed. Don't say oops. Okay, what can you do? You can put your fingertip right on your nose. All right, so antagonism is built into our bodies. All right, you're going to see that in terms of the musculoskeletal system, in terms of the endocrine system, in terms of the nervous system. And that's by far the most important thing that you can really learn in this class. And that is, antagonism is what? Good. It's a good thing, right? It provides for precise control and balance. All right, so here we see flexion of the cervical spine. All right, that is decreasing the angle of bones of your neck. And then extension is going to be what? The increasing the angle extension. And a few joints you can hyperextend, which means go beyond the normal limit. So, for instance, what other joints can you, should not hyperextend? So, for instance, your knee, when you decrease the angle, like that, what's that? That's flexion. Here is extension. Do you want to be able to hyperextend your knee? No, there's only a few joints that you should be able to hyperextend.
Can't some people do that, though, with their knees?
Maybe. Yeah, I've not seen that with their knee but some people have more range of motion of joints.
Fingers.
And fingers, some people can hyperextend their interphalangeal joints. I don't understand the anatomic basis for that. Maybe somebody's got some nice motion images in an MRI machine that shows why that's possible to do that without damaging those joints. Okay. So again, this is what? Flexion of your lumbar spine. This is extension, going back, hyperextension of your lumbar spine. Same for the cervical region. Okay, so here's flexion of the knee, extension of the knee. Or you could say, not just the knee, you could say flexion of, what part of the body is this right here? The leg. So you could say flexion of the leg or flexion of the knee means what? Exactly the same thing. All right, so you just get to pick which one you want to talk about. Okay, now the shoulder. I tell you what, let's look at the hip joint. All right, so not the knee. So here's flexion of the, knee, extension of the knee, and the hip. All right, so here's the hip. And don't look at my knee, just look at my thigh with regard to my trunk right here. What's happening to this angle? It is decreasing, so that is called flexion. What is this? This is extension. So you got to be familiar with these terms because we're going to start talking about muscles and which muscles produce a certain kind of activity, right? So flexion, extension of the hip, or flexion, extension of the thigh, right? Of the thigh. All right. Now here's one that really doesn't make any sense, and that is the shoulder joint. The shoulder joint is really complicated because it can do a lot of different kinds of motions. All right, but I want you to memorize the motion as it correlates to the thigh. So what is this again? Flexion, extension. So of the arm, this is flexion, and this is extension, and this is hyperextension. All right, so this is the picture you got to get in your mind, because what is the definition of flexion? It is decreasing the angle between two bones. What angle is being decreased when you flex your arm? Well, I don't see it anywhere, right? So how are you going to know that? The only way to know that is this is called flexion, this is called extension, right? And then hyperextension. So just think of the humerus and the femur working the same way. Maybe that's the reason why somebody named it that. All right, unless someone has another idea of why you would call this flexion. Okay, of the arm. All right, so your fingers, when you're in anatomic position, they can be close to each other, all right, or you can spread them out. And then when they're spread out, you can bring them close together again. So this has got a term as well. When you move something apart, away from midline, we call that abduction. And when you bring things back together on midline, that is adduction. Abduction, adduction. All right, so what am I doing here? I am abducting, right, to give you the peace sign in Vulcan. All right, so you can do that with your arms. Right, you can do that with your shoulder joint. This is abduction, this is adduction, and you can do that with your hip as well. What's another part of your body that you can adduct and abduct with? Your toes, right. Okay, but because your shoulder is a ball and socket joint, there's a motion that incorporates flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, because it's a ball and socket joint, and this is windmill motion. And the windmill motion is what we call circumduction. And there's only one other joint that you can circumduct, and that is your hip. Okay, that's actually a couple of joints working in your thumb. All right, and then of course rotation, lateral rotation, medial rotation between C1, C2, and your shoulder. All right, so guess what? We're going to have to stop and then start here with supination and dorsiflexion, plantar flexion on Wednesday. And the test is 1 week from today. So right now, next week, you'll be done with your second test. And where's that sign-in sheet at? Anybody know where the sign-in sheet is?